And hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM. CFRU.ca is Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
And Candace, this is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps.
Is it?
Oh. Yes.
Wait, this is what happens?
This is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps. And we'll explain that joke in a bit. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Thursday at 10 a.m. Correction, we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. I haven't updated the script.
Oh, we changed slots.
We did change slot. Wednesday at 2 p.m., so you did not miraculously shift time 18 hours in the future. Sorry about that. Wednesdays at 2 p.m., that script will be updated for next week. Glad we're not doing this live. Anyway... we meet to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new sci-fi fantasy flick, A Wrinkle in Time. That, however, will be in the back half of the show. For the first half, we wanted to mark a very special occasion, and it was exactly 20 years ago last week that a little movie called The Big Lebowski was released in theaters everywhere. And if you had never seen it, shame on you, but if you've never seen it, and or if you would like a little refresher, this is the refresher.
Okay, sir, you're a Lebowski, I'm a Lebowski. That's terrific. But I am very busy, as I imagine you are. What can I do for you, sir?
Well, sir, it's this rug I have, it really tied the room together.
You told Brandt on the phone, he told me. Where do I fit in?
Well, they were looking for you, these two guys.
Say it again. You told Brandt on the phone, he told me. I know what happened, yes, yes.
Oh, so you know that they were trying to piss on your rug.
Did I urinate on your rug?
You mean, did you personally come and pee on my rug?
Hello! Do you speak English, sir? Parla usted inglés? I'll ask you again. Did I urinate on your rug?
No, like I said, woo or peed on my rug.
I just want to understand this, sir. Every time a rug is micturated upon in this fair city, I have to compensate the person?
Come on, man. I'm not trying to scam anybody here.
You're just looking for a handout like every other... Are you employed, Mr. Lebowski?
Wait, let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? His dudeness or duder or, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
I think that was, speaking of the brevity thing, that gives you a good idea of the tone of the film. It's by the Coen brothers, of course. First of all, this is one of these weird instances where it's like it's been 20 years since this movie came out.
Time? 20 years? What?
Well said. Watching this earlier, it reminds me of when the Coen brothers do one of these comedies. It just makes me think there's a certain magic to it where either it works or it works slightly well. I mean, I'm not...
I was going to say, are you going to say, or it doesn't work? Because
no.
Have to give me an option. Like, give me... which one didn't work? Let's go.
Well, I mean, that... But that's a great point. Like, I know some people aren't fans of Hail Caesar. I was watching that... Mm. It was on TV earlier last week. And I started watching it about halfway through. It's not perfect by any means. It's not one of the great Coen brothers movies. But it works enough. And, you start to see certain patterns in these where it's about... kind of life going on, these characters in their insular worlds, and bam, a bunch of stuff happens. Sometimes someone dies, and then everything goes back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's just life, man.
It's just life. But it made me think that, you have ones like Lebowski, which is in the National Film Registry. It is a classic. It is sacrosanct. But then you have ones like Burn After Reading or Hail Caesar, the ones that don't work as well.
So, to be fair, I haven't seen Hail Caesar, but Burn After Reading. So, in preparation for this, of course, I do this exercise that I do fairly regularly, which is, all right, let me list my favorite Coen Brothers films and in what order. And it feels like an impossible task. But I think I've finally been able to come to grips, and I'm going to say it out loud.
Okay.
That despite the fact that I always put other films first, I think the reality is that Burn After Reading, for me, is my favorite Coen Brothers film. It's the one I go to most often, and then probably Big Lebowski, and then Blood Simple, which is a strange one, but...
Not a comedy.
No. But that's the great thing about the Coen Brothers, is that they don't do comedies. And in fact, you kind of watch, they almost do, particularly now, they tend to sort of flip a comedy and a quite a dark film. Certainly, I will say that, because The Big Lebowski came out just a couple years after Fargo.
Yep.
And I feel like Fargo was the first time I thought of the Coen Brothers. Like, I watched a movie and thought, oh, that is a Coen Brothers film. Mm-hmm. The other films before that, I'd seen Raising Arizona. Miller's Crossing, I really, really enjoyed. But to me, I didn't feel like any of those films were particularly part of one group.
Right.
But, you know, once Fargo, and I feel like just every film after that from the Coen Brothers just really feels like a Coen Brothers film.
Yeah, they took a while to find their style, and you know they started out with these very film noirish things, and then they had like it feels like kind of a goofy Lynchian phase with the Hudsucker Proxy and Barton Fink, which I think maybe people remember more as like being a Simpsons gag when Bart's friends drive by, it's like, we're gonna see Barton Fink, and I defy anyone to tell me what the synopsis for Barton Fink is, but and then we go into Fargo, Lebowski, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and into like the I guess the canon of the Coen Brothers, but yeah, I mean I enjoy Burn After Reading a lot more than
so I'm surprised when you say think it didn't work as well or wasn't as popular.
I don't think it was as popular.
Really?
But
maybe
I think if you're in a Burn After Reading crowd, it's
see, and I feel like I would say A Serious Man is the one that
that's an odd one.
Didn't work and wasn't as popular. I really, really loved it, but it was the one. Like, Burn After Reading, when I saw it, and I saw it a few times in the theater, people were always laughing.
Yeah.
Always laughing. And then a certain amount of dread at certain points. But A Serious Man, I was the only person laughing. Me and a person behind me who occasionally would laugh at jokes I didn't get because they were very Jewish.
Right.
So they got things I didn't, like, I would hear them laugh at things, you know, once the certain Yiddish words were coming. I was like, oh, that's a joke. I didn't get that joke. Okay. But that was it. It was just the two of us laughing in the whole theater.
Mm-hmm.
I think A Serious Man, while I loved it, is the one that didn't work. I hate to say didn't work because I think it did work. But I think it was the one that just people went expecting something and they got A Serious Man instead.
Right. I think
they went expecting Burn After Reading.
Right. I mean, there are ones like The Man Who Wasn't There and, you know, where they don't find the audience, or the audience isn't ready for what is seen, or the audience isn't ready for the picture.
Yeah.
A Serious Man, I don't think I've revisited that in a long time, probably since it first came out, and I probably should. But I remember the comedy in that being dark.
Yes.
So
very, very dark.
Speaking of a particular mindset, if you can go in, if you got like a head for gallows humor, I think that appeals to you. But it's interesting that they can push those lines and then come back, because after A Serious Man, that was like True Grit and Llewellyn
Davis.
And
then they do actually make really dark, like No Country for Old Men is, I feel like that's probably their darkest film. And so they can make a dark comedy and then yet just make a dark film with very little comedy in it. And that's such an art to me, because how do you define that? Like, this is just gruesome.
Right.
And this is gruesome and hilarious.
Right. And it's not that there isn't funny bits in No Country either.
Yeah.
it, which is weird. They seem to have this weird sense, the Coens, of, and it's like they have like a comedy dimmer somewhere in there. You know, it's like we're gonna take the comedy way down and then we're gonna turn it way up. Mm-hmm. And No Country is a great one to talk about in comparison to this, because it, mm-hmm. you know, it's about idiots doing crimes.
Yes.
And yeah. and then the one you have No Country, which is I think you would have some, I think you would very easily describe Anton Sugar as a kind of nihilist character. He is a force of just like pure darkness and death.
Right.
Where in Big Lebowski, you have guys who call themselves nihilists who are just...
They're just, I don't know. I think they were into the aesthetic.
They were into the aesthetic.
That was it. It was just an aesthetic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, so coming back to the Big Lebowski, I do think the Big Lebowski does a really good thing. Rather than doing that comedy and darkness, it's comedy and emotion. Like there's some real sort of heartstrings pulled in this film, which is sort of surprising.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, at the right time, we get the comedy too. But I feel like this one is really pretty heartfelt.
Yeah. I mean these are likable people, despite, you know, despite this whatever they're wrapped up in. But what I found interesting, what I found sort of focusing on watching it with a more critical mindset, was how are the dude and Walter friends?
Yeah, because one is very peace, right? And that's the whole thing. He's just like, he's a Buddhist, basically.
Yeah.
And yeah, Walter is still in Vietnam, I think.
Yeah, he goes there at night.
Yeah. Yeah, it is true. And the reality is, how are they friends? Bowling.
Probably.
Like, that's really it, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's sort of something we can think about. Like, you know, you really just, there's just this love of bowling. They just both really love this thing, and they set everything else aside so that they can, every, you know, Tuesday and Thursday, throw a few.
And then you throw Donnie in there, and you're not sure what function Donnie has. He's kind of there to, like, I guess, like, kind of pull exposition out of them. Mm-hmm. And not that that's like his point as a character, but he's always like, he's always catching dude and Walter in the middle of conversations, like, oh, what happened, dude? Or what do you mean, Walter?
Yeah.
And
tell me the audience.
And speaking of heartfelt, though, spoiler alert, Donnie dies of a heart attack in the end.
Everybody's seen this movie. It's been out for 20 years.
I feel like we have to do the disclaimer. We don't want to get sued. Anyway.
Sued by who?
You never know.
Libel suit or litigious. I can't speak.
Litigious. There are a lot of litigious people out there, is what she's saying.
Thank you.
But all through the movie, practically the only thing you ever hear Walter tell Donnie is shut the F up, Donnie.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is an inside joke because of the character Buscemi played in Fargo. But then at the end, like, Walter gives this beautiful eulogy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow, you really cared about Donnie, didn't you? And it's like, of course, Walter also brings it back to Vietnam. It's like, you took so many of our young people, like on Hill 319 and Ho Choi. And it's just, it's a beautiful eulogy that is, you know, kind of ruined when he
opens up the can of
the full. This is also after they're at the mortuary, haggling over the price of the urn.
But seriously, those things are expensive.
It's, you know what? That's the monopoly of the funeral industrial complex.
Oh, you can buy them at Costco now.
Well, there you go. That's just called commerce. But yeah. Walter, it's too bad Walter didn't know that in 1998. Well, the film is set in 91. But
was it set in 91? Because that's the thing. Like, I rewatched it. It was a few months ago, actually, because the Bookshelf does their Guelph Movie Club,
mm-hmm.
and maybe October or November, I don't remember. They showed The Big Lebowski, and so I went to go see it then. I didn't go see it just recently when they replayed it again. But you know, I watch it. I feel like it stands up. It feels a little bit like it's set out of time, and maybe that's why. You say it's it was made in 98, but set in 91. So maybe that's part of it. The fact that it was already sort of out of its own time.
I think the Sam Elliott narration makes the point. This was set in sometime around during the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
But it really has no bearing other than the fact that the Saddam is the bowling, the guy with the bowling shoes in the dream sequence. And I think Walter makes some vague reference comparing the Gulf War to Vietnam at one point. But it's interesting because I was thinking about that, too. It's like, why is this set in 1991? Six or seven years earlier? It just seems like one of those quirks. It's just like, well, we can't set it today, so maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. What's a good time to tell this story? I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's or maybe it was to, I mean, because cell phones were kind of prevalent at that point. Maybe it's to have like have the dude walk around with like one of those attaché case phones. That
those were so great.
And it also leads to the great line where the dude's walking away with the phone, and Donnie goes, "Phone's ringing, dude."
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Donnie.
The cast in this film are like top notch. It's amazing, you know.
Yeah.
And so, sort of, you know, when you revisit it and you go, "Oh yeah, that one. Oh yeah, and that person and that person." Not a single person in this gives a poor performance.
This is Tara Reid's best work.
You're right. It really, really is.
This is before Sharknado ruined her.
Or American Pie, for that matter. It might have been the American Pie years.
I don't think they even brought her back for the third one.
You watched all the way up to the third one? Okay.
They've made like 20 of them. Including all the direct-to-video spinoffs. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's also like a Coen Brothers who's who, you know, because you got Peter Stormare in there and John Turturro and John Goodman pops up and Jeff Bridges, you know, they're frequent collaborators.
Yeah, Buscemi.
Didn't I say Buscemi?
Anyway, maybe I wasn't listening
we'll check
to
the
you
tapes.
At all.
Well, then, yeah. What else is new? Yeah, it's like the cast is really great. Like John Turturro, who people may not realize he's like making like a sequel to his character in Big Lebowski, who's named Jesus, or as he calls himself,
Jesus.
The Jesus. Well, he says Jesus.
Yeah.
Don't F with the Jesus. Anyway,
yeah.
It's a remake of a French film called.
I'm confused here.
Yeah. No. I'm as confused as well because I was looking this up and it's called. It's a remake of a French film called Going Places. That is also a backdoor sequel to The Big Lebowski, starring John Turturro as Jesus, written and directed by John Turturro.
What?
Exactly.
Can we just talk about him in Transformers? That makes so much more sense.
Oh,
that which was the last movie that I was here to talk about with John Turturro in it.
I think that was the last movie chronologically I've seen him in, which is sad. But yeah, I mean, rewatching it, and made me remind myself that he's like basically in the movie for 2 minutes.
Yeah,
like
he's sort of introduced as a villain.
Yeah.
You know, it's the like main competitor, and then we kind of, that's it.
Right. It's set up that he's like the one they have to face in the bowling tournament.
Yeah.
And
then we get sidetracked.
Then we get sidetracked. It's weird because there's so much packed into this movie and so many different characters. And, you know, there's Jackie Treehorn and the adult film producer, and there's Maude Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
And she has her own agenda, and Big Lebowski, and all the stuff going on with Walter and taking side trips to high school students' houses. Because I do want to play this bit because it is perhaps the best bit of like censoring for made for TV that has ever happened.
Oh,
it's too good not to play.
Castle stonewalling me.
Walter, what are you doing, man? What are you doing?
Here you go, Larry. You see what happens? You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens? This is what happens, Larry. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps? This is what happens. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens, Larry? This is what what happens when you feed a slaughtered scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
Wow. That's not how I remember that scene playing
out.
No,
that's not how I remember the scene either. But it's, you know, rewatching that scene with the salty language intact, because he does say find a stranger in the Alps, but a different version mm-hmm. several more times. Mm-hmm. But
feed a stranger some eggs? Was yeah, that the other one?
That was, I think that was where they got chop sake with it. But the kid who plays Larry, mm-hmm. dead face. He doesn't say a thing in that scene. It is, he's completely dead face. And Walter goes after the car, and I found this kind of a recurring theme in the film. The dude makes like a random observation. They because they're looking for the money, the ransom money, and they pull up to this kid's house because the dude finds his homework in his stolen car. And so they're trying to find the ransom money, this briefcase with $1 million in it, and they pull up in front of the kid's house, and in front of the house is a sports car, and the dude mm-hmm. says, oh, he must have spent the money on the car, and Walter runs with it.
Yep, that's what happened.
Walter just, he's like, they sit down with this punk kid who I don't think even looked old enough to drive, but yeah. I somehow he afforded a sports car in Walter's mind. But this happens all the time, and it mm-hmm. happens earlier in the film when dude says that he bet, oh, you know, probably Bunny kidnapped herself.
Yep.
And then Walter's, then that becomes Walter's, like,
basically the entire film happens because
Walter hears one thing yeah. and it becomes fact.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, there's definitely an analogy there today with
yeah.
like some of the stuff happening in politics where people will hear something randomly on Facebook, Twitter, or whatever, and that becomes fact.
Yeah.
You cannot convince them otherwise. You can't talk them down.
I'm just musing, talking things through out loud.
Right.
Like, it's like the part in, you know, the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? You're like, talk
right.
it out, talk it out. It's
right.
not until you say, I've locked in, that, like,
that's
now
right.
what I'm saying matters.
Well, there you go.
That's what America needs to do. Just
remember,
it's just everyone's just talking it out. Nobody has said they locked it in yet. Did you know I could bring Regis Philbin into this?
Kids, ask your parents about Regis Philbin. It's because I don't think he's been connected with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire for a while. I think anyway.
Meredith.
Meredith, you can give me that. It's an old one. Isn't Cedric? We're getting off topic.
It's not a TV show, folks. It's a movie show.
That's right. But we go to interesting places. Speaking of interesting places, I did revisit some of the reviews, and there was actually negative reviews. And this goes back to like what we were talking about at the top. It's like how thinly these, on such a thin line, these films work. And The Guardian wrote, it's a bunch of ideas shoveled into a bag.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's Coen Brothers
movie. That's
the
point.
Yeah.
You're right. Yes, Guardian.
But he meant it as an insult. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, I do find it interesting because, of course, Fargo had just come out before this, and Fargo had quite a lot, like, was really critically well received.
Yeah.
And I think the audience has really received it quite well
yeah.
as well. And I wonder if some of that was because it did have a lot of that Coen Brothers weirdness to it, but it, I think, followed an easier to sort of understand mystery.
Yeah, it was a murder mystery.
Yeah. So I think that was, it was an entry point into this weird, strange world of the Coen Brothers. And so,
because that's where a lot of people discovered them.
Yeah.
Was on Fargo. And it sort of, I don't know if it, like, you want to say watered down the Coen-y things just enough that, it, you know, dressing it up as a murder mystery. And then you get something like The Big Lebowski, which is
all Coen.
It's all Coen.
All the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, for sure. I'm just kind of looking up to see what the box office results of the Coen Brothers. I wondered if Fargo was their best one. I don't think, no. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou was their best one.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because, again, that was, and see, it's interesting because that was like a super weird sort of little film.
Right.
That really took off. And I don't know what the magic was there, whether it was George Clooney or whether it was the soundtrack. But it was like, when you actually look at the film, it's kind of a super weird little
yeah.
thing.
The soundtrack had a big part of it. Mm-hmm. I remember because I was working at Sellers at the time in the electronics department, and we moved a lot of old country or old soundtracks.
Yeah.
Along with whatever NSYNC or Backstreet Boys. I mean, they're still around. Bravo. I think that was another example of the alchemy. How often does Oh Brother come up in conversation about the Coen brothers among their... I mean, I think at the time mm-hmm. it was very, very popular, but I think people go for the Lebowski and Fargo and kind of consider that peak. And then maybe also, I hear a lot about Llewellyn Davis being an underrated True Grit as well.
I really enjoyed that, yeah.
But anyway...
It's tough. I don't know. The Coen brothers just keep making really great films,
mm-hmm.
and each one of them is great. So how do you compare them to each other?
They're great in their own way. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I don't think there's one of them I outright hate. And I can see issues with some of them, but I mean, you love them just the same, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do next, and... I think we can always agree that the music in a Coen Brothers movie is especially enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And so because we spent all this time talking about the Big Lebowski and wherever our minds went, I thought we'd just play something nice from the Big Lebowski soundtrack. One of the underrated cuts. And T-Bone Burnett did this, and he does a lot of the mm-hmm. Coen Brothers movies. Yeah. And this is a nice find, I think, considering of the dude's feelings about the Eagles. It is the Gypsy Kings version of Hotel California. So we'll be right back with the review of this week's new release, which is A Wrinkle in Time. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Sonar y me dijo ya mi mismo que todo del cielo ella se me una vela y nuestra de camino soy moza el coreador y yo te dije diciendo welcome to the Hotel California such a lovely place such a lovely place welcome to the Hotel California.
Call me Mrs. What's It.
Mrs. Who?
No, Mrs. What's It. Mrs. Who is, she's like a billion years older and way more knowledgeable.
What can I do for you, Mrs. What's It?
I caught her stealing sheets. Guys, she's harmless.
You're six. Come on, what do you know about harmless?
Have I ever been wrong?
Well, one of these days you might be Charles Wallace.
Oh, I highly doubt that. He's one of the greatest minds in recent history. He's prodigious. But of course, we can't take any credit for our talents. It's how we use them that counts.
Heard it here first. That is a clip from A Wrinkle in Time. It is a new film from Ava DuVernay. And it stars Storm Reid, Levi Miller, Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon, Mindy Kaling, and Chris Pine. It is based on... the book of the same name, which I believe is a series, and has famously been described as unfilmable. And I guess Ava DuVernay's proved them wrong, but I would submit she hasn't entirely proved them wrong, because I think mm-hmm. this film definitely has the strains of somebody struggling to turn what I'm sure is a very complicated book into a more streamlined Disney type of movie.
Yeah, it certainly before I say this, I absolutely loved it.
Oh, I liked it too.
But there certainly were times when I was just like, oh, this feels like it could be so much bigger and longer and more epic, and I am really regretting the need for them to have to just put it all into one movie, because I want to see this given the Hobbit treatment, where one tiny book was turned into three very long movies.
Did you read the book? Have you read the book?
I did when I was a young girl, like every other young girl ever. And I don't actually remember very much about it. What's funny is as I'm watching the film, I'm like, the only thing I really remember is there was a when they were explaining The Wrinkle in Time was about ants on a string and how the two ants can't meet in the middle, but then if the so they actually did that sort of video, but with the two worlds on it, and then the right. Wrinkle in Time and how you just wrinkled it, yeah, except that it was ants on a string in the book. But like I read it so long ago, and I remember loving it, and I remember that all of my girlfriends loved it, and I for some reason I don't remember a lot about the story, and I don't understand why. I think it's probably because people just didn't really talk about it outside, you know, the way that everybody talks about Charlotte's Web and everybody, like all these other sort of really popular books that, you know, the sort of young chapter books, you know, that you would read kind of between 10 and 12, right? Where it's not quite like a young adult novel, but it's certainly not a kid's book. It's that in between sort of thing. And so many of those, I think people still talk about them and talk about the stories. And for some reason, A Wrinkle in Time just kind of, it kind of disappeared, I think, for a really long time. People just sort of didn't. It didn't pick up the way some of those other stories did, or sort of maintain the classicness of it until recently when it has sort of come back.
That's interesting because there were a lot of young people who were there when I watched it.
Me too.
And there were a lot of young women who were clearly fans and were digging seeing favorite characters appear and...
Yeah, I feel like it's, you know, in the last maybe 10 years or something, it's sort of been coming back. But yeah, I did find as I looked around that there were a lot of women my age and up to about 20 years older. So there was like, you know, girlfriends going out to see the movie together. And then a lot of families with mostly daughters. There were some boys in the audience, and I worry that not enough boys are going to see this film. Whether it's because parents are sort of going, oh, it's a, you know, it's a movie for girls or what, or if they see it that way, which it isn't. It absolutely is not.
No, but, I didn't feel like that.
Yeah. But I felt like there weren't enough boys in the audience.
I guess maybe it's that weird thing because the heroine, the main heroine is a young woman. The three kind of powerful beings who help her on her way are women. She, you know, it's the dad in distress, which is an unusual trope that may not be an actual trope that I just coined, the dad in distress.
I feel like that's often the case though with women heroines, right? When you look at Philip Pullman's story, it's the same thing. The dad has been kidnapped.
Yeah, that's right.
The series of books that I can't remember the name of, but Brendan Fraser played the father. It was about the books, like the book about the books.
Oh, Inkheart.
Inkheart, same thing, right? So the father goes missing and the daughter steps up to find.
So, interesting. So yeah, it is a trope.
It's a really common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm glad we...
figured that part out.
I'm glad that this literary exploration is...
there are only seven stories. Is that what they say, right?
yeah. I've read some of some negative reviews of this, and one of the complaints I heard from Richard Krauss, actually, when I saw his review on the news on Friday, was that it's like a CGI overload, and I actually didn't feel that. Because there's this weird thing in it where Ava DuVernay does a lot of close-ups of faces, and I feel like if it's like any one of like 100 guy directors, it would all be about the wide shots and the vistas and look at all this, look at all these creatures and the other things. And I think the story is very well focused on the characters, and the world is in the context of just that thing that's around them. I think where the story suffers, I think the story actually suffers, as you were saying, like a lack of imagination, especially when they go to like the dark world. Kamazots. I think that suffers from, I don't know if it's just like they were.
It felt rushed.
It felt rushed. Like a lot of effort was in the first world they go to, mm-hmm. with like these flying rocks in the air and the flowers that are little fairy things. And when Mrs. Whatsit becomes like a giant leaf creature, yeah. you know, there's so much there. And then when they get to the Comitats, it's, you know, it's a forest. And then it's like it's like the bridge from 2001.
Yeah, I would agree that, and that's exactly sort of when it switched to them, the missus leaving with the kids, you know, on Kamzats to rescue her dad. That's sort of when I said, I checked the time, and this movie is only an hour and 49 minutes. Like, I feel like we spent an hour and 15 at least already, and it was great. It was a really good hour and 15 minutes, and now you're just going to give me a half hour, like. This needs to be longer. It needed to be longer.
Which is a weird...
Or two films it's, or something.
Yeah, which is not something you try and say, it, or you like to say, that you know you needed to be longer. But yeah, this did suffer when they go to Comitas, because it definitely feels like not a separate movie, but it feels like they had a really good first half. Mm-hmm. And then somebody remembered there's a story to resolve with a missing dad and an evil thing.
But
and,
to be fair, the story to resolve really is her story, right? It really is much like any other story set for kids, you know, sort of between 10 to 12. It really is about learning who you are, learning to trust yourself, learning to love yourself, all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so she did a lot of that. I mean, I can sort of, if I'm not looking at it as an adult, and I'm maybe, and maybe this is it. Maybe the book was sort of rushed this way too. I don't remember. I would like to reread it. But if the bulk of the story really is about her growth, that's, you know, a lot of that does happen in one section. And now it's the, okay, now you need to be tested. We've given you everything you need. Mm. Now you need to enact those. And that, you know, maybe doesn't need to be as big a part.
Maybe.
But I feel like, I mean, it's hard to say, right? Is the movie for us 40 plus year olds, or is the movie for kids, you know, 8 through 16?
Yeah, because I'm not sure the kids would analyze it on that level. But...
One kid did. I heard one kid in the audience who said, "Oh, finally, she found her dad." Like, this one kid, when it happened, it was just like, "Oh, I've been waiting this whole time to figure out when she was going to find her dad." So, at least one kid.
Okay. Well, we should get that kid in for a guest host. Anyway, yeah, there's, you know, there's something to that. I think, again, it may be just maybe the way Ava DuVernay saw the story, and she may very well see it as you described, and I think perhaps we're maybe used to an epic plot like this being very externally focused and not mm-hmm. internally focused, which is like, what does the hero or heroine learn? How do they grow? What do they bring back aside from the MacGuffin that they go out into the world or the universe to find? But yeah, it's tricky, and you know, that maybe just be a bias on our part. Mm-hmm. But I did like the cast.
Yeah, the cast was really, really strong.
Mm-hmm. I liked how Oprah appears out of like a shimmer of light and is the size of the house. That was a little on the nose.
Yeah. do you know what? I did notice at one moment, because of course there is, again, the trope of the wise old black woman.
Sure.
And Oprah very much did play that role, that stereotype, you know, maybe like even a Jungian sort of stereotype, right, of the old crone who knows everything. But somehow, despite the fact that she was literally filling that role, it just didn't feel the same way. And I don't know if it was because the main character, the heroine, was also black, so it felt a lot less like, oh, we got to bring in, you know, here's the old wise black woman who's going to give us all the answers we need.
It's also offset that she's not alone, that there are two others, and that they're very representative. You know, Mindy Kaling, who's of Indian descent, and Reese Witherspoon, who's Whitey McWhiterson. But it's...
Loved that red hair. It was like the perfect shade of red. I'm like, that's the red I want my hair to be. Totally not real.
It was... it's hard to believe she's like Reese Witherspoon is pushing 50.
Yeah, she looked great.
Yeah.
And she's done, you know, she's done a really great job of taking America's Sweetheart role away from Sandra Bullock and making it less problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I think Sandra Bullock necessarily makes it problematic, but Reese Witherspoon, I think, has done a really great job of not only being America's Sweetheart, but also using that power to lift other people up.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting aside. what I was getting at was...
Sorry, I was totally not related to the movie.
It's
Do you know
cool.
what? This movie is just so kind of politically rife, unfortunately.
Yes.
So to me, it's just so much around it, too, I think about it as well.
Right, because the family is mixed race, which I think in the book they are Caucasian.
Yeah.
But so that's a very deliberate decision to make them mixed race. And I think Chris Pine even said that was one of the things he found appealing, that it was not just a mixed race family, but also because the younger kid, Charles Wallace, is adopted.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a, I don't know, it's a mixed race too, or family, or mixed race, mixed family. But going back to our three powerful wizard ladies.
Misses.
The misses. I'm not sure in what universe you would say, let's bring together Mindy Kaling, Reese Witherspoon, and Oprah as, you know, as a trinity, because it's not like a trio you would automatically think of, but I think they all work very, very well together.
I think you don't spend enough time on feminist Twitter.
Obviously not.
Because that's a pretty strong feminist triad right there.
Fair enough. But it's speaking for me, I guess, it is an unexpected pairing of the three of them, and it works quite well. And maybe that offsets, because, you know, you're right about the wise old black woman, and there, you know, there's also the wise old black man trope as well.
Yeah.
And but, you know, I'm not sure, because most of the times in these stories, the old wizard character who gives our heroes, and, you know, the powers to send them on their adventure, typically is a male figure too. So, you know, we're kind of trope breaking all over the place.
Yeah. Sort of introducing them, but then just twisting them a little bit, or making them work better, making them actually fit the way they should. Because there's nothing wrong with learning from a wise old black woman.
Like, no.
You know, that person has a lot of experience that I could stand to learn from.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing I liked is that the family wasn't, like, messed up. Like, the point wasn't to resolve family issues, that it was, a loving family, and that, you know, because of what happens to the dad, and the dad disappears, and that leaves a rift, obviously, as it would. But, you know, there's no kind of, I guess... What's the word I'm looking for? Dysfunction.
Yeah,
internal
even her
the family. Yeah.
Acting out.
Yeah,
is not bad or unexpected, really. And not only that, it doesn't, as you say, create a rift at home.
Right.
You know, when she gets called into the principal's office, it's
right. And there's nothing to it that, you know, the kids don't. The one girl that she smacks with a basketball doesn't have it coming too, but then that's inverse later on, that, you know, she gets an idea that the it, which is the bad guy, you know, affects all these people, and bringing out the most negative aspects of herself, including the principal who calls her into his office, including the mean girl. It's I'm trying to think of, it's Tomorrowland is the one I'm thinking of.
Hmm.
That there was a similar message to that in Tomorrowland, that Wrinkle in Time very, in a much better way, uses the ideas. But the idea in Tomorrowland too was that, you know, our negative aspects and our negative feelings sort of create this self-fulfilling thing in us that, you know, we're, you know, our bad faults and things, although faults aren't bad because Mrs. Watson gives her the gift of faults, but these negative feelings and thoughts that we have are pushing ourselves into further negative directions. And that was, I mean, that's a message I think resonates too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think they did a great job of really sort of sending us home with a lot of clear messages.
Yeah.
You know, and that love conquers, and, you know, the acceptance and, that sort of darkness that gets in people is what causes them to spread the darkness. So
right.
I feel like there were a lot of things that were handed to us to bring home, but not in a really over the top, like after school special sort of way.
No.
I think they did a really nice job of introducing those. And I feel like for kids between, you know, 8 to 12 or 16 or whatever, they're, especially if they're seeing the film with their parents,
mm-hmm.
I think both sides can learn a lot and then have some really great conversations about it afterwards.
Yeah, it leaves you thinking, and it makes you want to sort of explore those some of those thoughts and ideas. One of the things I like about it is, and I thought this wasn't pushed far enough, was that her father and mother being scientists, teacher from an early age, to like and appreciate science, and that comes into play in some respect in the story. I thought it would actually come into play more, that, you know, the movie called A Wrinkle in Time, there would be some more like math magic or what have you to help save
magic,
the day.
It's science.
Well,
it just seems like magic,
right?
Just like Carl Sagan said.
That's
whatever that quote is.
Yeah, but I did like that message too. You know, to be open to new possibilities and you know, enjoy science, and that science can unlock the mysteries of the universe, and it shouldn't be something to be feared or belittled. Or I think that's a positive message, and to see a young girl talk about science and use science to get out of jams, that's powerful
too.
To fly, yeah.
I fell for that scene. That was really well done.
Yeah.
That was, I think the whole movie was just really nicely done. I agree that there could have been so much more. It's such an epic story, and I think that's a good sign that I wanted more out of it. I don't think that it was big CGI fest. I mean,
no.
We went to an alternate dimension, a different planet. Like, I expected it to look different.
Yeah.
And just to sort of bring it back a little bit to something we'll talk about a couple weeks from now, Ready Player One, which is a book that I read, and I've seen the trailer for it, and I dislike the inside the Oasis CGI effect of their faces and things, and I feel like I'm gonna come out of that movie unhappy because it's gonna be a giant CGI fest, and I don't want that. And that's not how I felt at all about this film. I think they did a really great job of making these fantastical places, so I'm okay that these little flowers that were sort of flying were CGI, because that it's not like anything here.
I feel like a different filmmaker would have made them like talking, like English talking, because they're very clearly communicating with each other. But they would have hired some British person and gone, "Watch a governor, I'm a flower creature," or something like that. it's very subtle, and I think DuVernay was very subtle in how and why she used it, and a lot of it's just character work. Like, it's, you know, it's they go see a seer played by Zach Galifianakis, and it's just Zach Galifianakis in a funny outfit, and I have a feeling, you know, in a different director's hands, that would have been a mocap character or some such nonsense.
That would have been awful.
Yeah, and I think that it's a film that it's an epic film of that shows a director's restraint.
Yeah.
That Ava DuVernay had like the, I'm not sure how much of this is true because I'm reading about the movie that apparently Disney was aiming for something a little on the cheaper side when making a Wrinkle in Time movie. Mm. That, but that's why it was in development heck for so long.
Yeah.
But Ava DuVernay has the talent and the resources of Disney, but she doesn't go hog wild with it.
Yeah.
And Lord knows she could have, and Lord knows maybe she should have. There was an article I was reading where she says, you know, she's kind of aware of what a rare opportunity this is, being a black female director and getting the Disney blank check to make something like this. And she turned down a lot of stuff to do this. You know, a lot of people wanted to do Star Wars and do Marvel and do, and you know, all sorts of things. So this was a big bet for her. And she could have gone bigger to ensure herself. And it's like, well, you can't, you know, I went as big as possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if it doesn't work out, the bigger you go, I think there's more of a forgiveness factor. And she was enormously restrained here. And I think that pays off. And that's, I think the movie's all the better for it.
Yeah. I think Disney spent most of their money on their soundtrack. The music in this was great.
Yeah, it was
all
great.
All of the songs were really, really good. Yeah. I anticipate lots of lip syncs to many of those songs on Musical.ly. And I also just want to mention the Levi
Miller.
Miller, yeah, who played Calvin, the friend who came. You know, Disney is just really, really good at finding young talent. And young talent, like cute young talent, right? Like that kid is going to be on a lot of like closet doors.
Yeah, he's the next Zac Efron.
Yeah, like he's, you know, he's really good. He was a very capable actor too, which is, you know, like sometimes, like, I don't know how I feel with Zac Efron. I'm not really too fond. But, you know, that's...
Are you looking forward to the Ted Bundy movie? He's just playing Ted Bundy in a movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. I tried to avoid Zac Efron films in general. So
he tries so hard.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, that is a talent they have, is to find that young talent. And I think that they've really, like, all three of the actors who are the kids, Charles Wallace, Meg, and Calvin, were really strong, especially the Charles Wallace, because that, I'm not sure how old that actor is. He's playing someone who's supposed to be about 6, I think.
Yeah, you're right.
And I suspect he's probably about 8, maybe 9.
His name's Derek McCabe, and he is, it doesn't say how old he is here.
He has a lot credits to do in this film. You know, he had to play a 70-year-old man in a 6-year-old's body.
Basically, yeah.
And did a great job of it. Did a really, I believed him all the time. I never thought, like, oh, I'm a child actor doing this best.
Yeah, it wasn't annoying as sometimes these characters are. I think I wanted him at times to dial it back, but I'm not sure how you tell a kid actor to dial it back. Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, there was a lot on his shoulders, and he did well. Yeah, the kids are great. And I like how, even though Meg is kind of the doubter, I want to say, of the group, the skeptic, there's never a moment where she's like, no, we're not doing this adventure. This is craziness, and we're not doing. And I find, again, that plays into kind of like the pro science theme, but everyone's like incredibly game to go on this adventure, and it's, you know, why not? Let's go to other dimensions and go through these shimmers and take the tesseracts, and yeah, it's just a lot of fun. It's a very upbeat movie, which I appreciate. Lord knows we need more upbeat.
Yes.
No cities were destroyed in the making of this movie. It's just a really heartwarming story. And it has its faults, but I think it's a movie worth seeing and worth enjoying.
Yep.
Excellent. It's nice when we all agree. Well, I'm afraid that does bring us to the end of our hour. And that means cue the sad Westworld music. Anyway, you can stay connected to End Credits at our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Candace, when you're out tesseracting around the universe, where can people follow your journey?
Well, you just follow me everywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's C-I-N-N-4-8. You can find all the different dimensions I end up in. And please also tune in to the podcast I help produce for The Bookshelf called The Village Podcast by The Bookshelf.
Excellent. And speaking of other shows I do, we'll be here Thursday at 5 p.m. for Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz there, and you can find it on CFRU here. And you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, and you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. Got it right that time. For more End Credits, we will see you then.